struggling with is some turnover. And I think that they're going to give you an overview and talk a little bit about what's going on with them and where they're at. And with that, that's about all I've got.
Good. Good morning, Mr. Gamson.
Good morning, Chair Johnson. Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Paul Gamson. I am the chair of the Employment Relations Board. We are here this morning, as I understand it, on Senate Bill 5511 and several other fee bills which deal with the appropriation for the funding of the agency of the Employment Relations Board for the 07-09 biennium. We appreciate the opportunity to be here to tell you our story and, as was pointed out, to work with you on some of the challenges and opportunities that are facing the agency. I understand that several months ago the prior chair of the agency met with this committee and gave a thorough overview. I'm not going to repeat it in any thoroughness, but I would like to take just maybe a three-minute refresher and focus on those structural things that I think are going to put into context the things that we're going to discuss further. Essentially, what we are is the labor court for the state of Oregon for public employees. We administer three separate statutory schemes. One is the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, which establishes collective bargaining rights for public employees and establishes the bargaining process they follow. A second statutory scheme is the State Personnel Relations Law, which essentially is the civil service law for state employees. Does not cover local government employees, but for state employees who are not unionized. And then the third law, which generates very few cases, is a private sector collective bargaining law, which covers those private sector employers that are too small, either because of income or because they don't affect interstate commerce enough to be covered by the National Labor Relations Act. Under all three of these laws, the agency's mission is essentially to resolve workplace disputes. The statutes give us three different kinds of tools to work with, three different dispute resolution mechanisms, and we use them depending on how or on what the dispute is. And I want to talk about it for a second because we've organized the agency around these different mechanisms and we've organized our performance measures around these different dispute resolution mechanisms. The first is if the question is whether employees want to be covered by a union, and if they do, which union. The mechanism we use to find that out to resolve that dispute is an election, quite simply. If the dispute is labor and management unable to reach a collective bargaining agreement at the table, we have a staff of trained mediators who go to the parties, bring an outside viewpoint, and as we'll see in the performance measures, are really quite successful in helping the parties come to an agreement. And then the third kind of dispute resolution mechanism is virtually for every other kind of dispute, it's a contested case, which is essentially like a trial, sworn witnesses, direct and cross-examination, rules of evidence, and the like. And as I said, we are organized around these three different kinds of dispute resolution mechanisms. So we've got an elections coordinator, we have a hearings division, and we have a conciliation and mediation staff.
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Paul, is your elections coordinator position currently filled?
Yes, it is. It's a half-time position.
Thank you. Is that all, Senator?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
The agency performs all these different dispute resolution functions now with 12 staff members, and I bring this up because in the early mid-90s, we were up to as high as 24 employees. We're now down to 12, and as we talk about the performance measures, I think what is reflected in the reduction in staff is that we are failing to meet our reasonable timeliness goals in terms of production.
I want to come back and visit with that in greater detail before you move into your presentation. I've done this budget ever since I came into the legislature, and there are people that are new to the body, and there are people that are new to Ways and Means on this panel. This agency had quite a series of backlogs. There were some very substantial personnel changes. I think particularly with your appointment to the board, you began to catch up, and now it appears that there are backlog issues again, and maybe you could describe a little bit of the history of what has transpired, other than the personnel reductions. I mean, ostensibly you've been cut in half, and the workload has gone up.
The workload, I think, has remained level, certainly on an individual basis, Chair Johnson, the workload has increased for the individuals. I think that what we've seen has been a fairly leveling off of the number of cases that we've had.
Okay.
And there were the staff reductions. So the backlogs are, frankly, occurring at two different places. One is in the hearings division, which is, I think, strictly just a numbers issue, a staff numbers issue. The other has been at the board itself, the three-person board appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. The history of the board was from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a group of three people who stayed together for 16 years. After that, there was a group of three that replaced them that stayed together for 8 years. So there's been a lot of stability. And that, you know, they found their ways to work together as collectively as a group. I came on the board in July, I think, of 2003, and since that time, the other two positions, there's a vacancy now. When that vacancy is filled, in those other two positions, there will be six different people in that short period of time. And what happens when there is turnover of that kind of magnitude, we have cases pending, a new person comes in, there's a different vote, they have to get up to speed, they have to learn how to do the job, and it has frankly led to some backlogs. Some stability on the board, I think, is the main thing that's going to be needed to deal with that.
Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted to get on the record, because I knew that there had been some considerable degree of instability, and thank you for providing that background. Senator Woodson.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Paul, do you have an opinion as to why there's such an incredible turnover in board members and also in employee members?
Chair Johnson, Senator Whitsitt, I it would be speculation, frankly, for me to say. So what I can say is that one of the people who resigned several years ago in her resignation letter said that it was a combination of the politicization of the board and the fact that the board doesn't have sufficient resources to do its job, and she wasn't willing to continue. The other people, I won't pretend to speak for them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Continuing with the overview, actually, I think the last piece that is important to know is the funding sources. We essentially have three separate funding sources. One is general fund. One is a per capita assessment on state on all state agencies. It's an assessment that has been steady for 6 years at $1.35. We haven't had an increase in 6 years. In fact, I went back and looked at 10 years, and it's been increased by 2 cents in 10 years. The governor's recommended budget recommends increasing it from $1.35 to $1.50 in recognition of two things. One is just simply the increased cost of doing business in the last 10 years, and second is to pay for a portion of the additional administrative law judge that the governor is recommending.
This is just a curiosity on my part, because we've been wrestling with the question I'm about to ask you in another context. How does the per head assessment get collected? And the reason I'm asking, colleagues, is that we've been wrestling with how to fund GSPC, Government Standards and Practices, and one of the recommendations was a per-head assessment, and there was an allegation that a bureaucratic superstructure would build around this collection mechanism that would be complicated to deal with. And I'd just like your opinion on how your collection mechanism works, and is there dispute over what constitutes an FTE, where you've got big operations that rotate part-time people in and out? Give us just your insight.
No, I don't have huge insight to it, because I frankly don't administer it on a day-to-day basis. We do it on payroll and in my time as chair, and in fact, all of my time on the board, other than one minor dispute about whether a particular group should or should not be included there, it's actually been quite smooth.
What's the collection point? Does DAS collect it for you? Or?
Yes, DAS collects it for us. And like I say, it's done through payroll.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crummel.
Thank you. Paul, you mentioned $1.35 or whatever it is, per head. Is that per month or?
Chair Johnson, Representative Crummel, yes, that's a per month assessment.
Okay, thank you.
Now that we've interrupted you just fiercely, please continue.
Well, that's fine. I appreciate you. Any information I can give to help you folks make the decision, I appreciate the opportunity to do that. The third funding mechanism that we have is fees. The statute imposes a $250 fee on filing an unfair labor practice complaint, a $100 fee on filing an answer to an unfair labor practice complaint, and a $1,000 fee that's split equally between the parties for mediation. So, and that is the briefest. If there are additional questions, I'm happy to answer them on the overview. If not, I understand that the thing that you would like me to do is to proceed with the performance measures.
Yes, please.
I would draw your attention to our book behind Appendix A, which is where they begin, and the real information begins on page 5. And before I launch into going through these one by one, two general comments about our performance measures. One is that we significantly rewrote the performance measures in the last session, so for a number of the performance measures, there's not going to be a long history to track and look at trends. And the other thing is to talk about the kinds of things we can and cannot measure in our agency. We are there's no good way really to measure the quality of the work for the most part. We're like a court in that it doesn't matter whether someone gets convicted or not convicted. What matters is the process. And so with us, it doesn't matter whether labor management wins, who wins an election. What matters is the fairness and the timeliness of the process. So as we go through, I think what you're going to see is not all, but most of our measures deal with the timeliness of the provision of services, because that, as it turns out, is really the main thing that we can measure. Starting on page 5, our performance measure 1, and this is the performance measure that deals with our elections division. We last time divided it into two parts because there are two different kinds of processes that occur when a party files an elections petition. The on the right-hand side of the page, there's two charts. The bottom chart is the chart for elections where there's no. It's on page 5 behind Appendix A.
Thank you.
It's for elections where there's no challenges and thus no need for contested case hearing. And we are actually doing very well below target. I realize in going through this, sometimes it's good to be below target and sometimes it's bad to be below target. It's kind of like, are you playing golf or are you bowling? Are you looking for a low score or looking for a high score? This one's golf. We want a low score. And for uncontested elections, we're actually below the target. The other measure is for contested elections, which means that once the petition is filed, someone raises a whole variety of legal challenges, and that takes it out of the elections division, puts it over into the hearings division, which, as we're going to see, is the place where a lot of the backlog is, and things are slow. So what we see here is, not surprisingly, that that elections petitions, representation petitions that require a hearing are slower than they should be and considerably above being a bad thing, considerably above the target.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Paul, do you have would you have current election requests for contested elections?
Chair Johnson, Senator Whitson, am not sure what's pending. I know of one case that's pending before the full board, and I don't know, frankly, whether any are pending in front of administrative law judges. If you would like, we can compile that information quite easily and get it over to you.
I would appreciate that. You're unaware of any contested cases, then?
I said I'm aware of one that's pending now in front of the board. It's gone through the administrative hearings process. There was a recommended order, objections filed to the recommended order, oral arguments to the board, and the final order is currently pending. That's the one case that I'm aware of.
Follow up, Senator, what's it?
And would that be a case that is causing this bar graph to go very high?
Actually, I don't believe that it's that case alone. The bar graph here is for, as I understand it, is for cases completed in 2006, and it certainly would be part of what made it go high, but I don't know if there were others decided at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, follow-up.
Is that, would this particular case we're talking about, would that be included in this graph since it's not, since it wasn't completed?
It would not be, I'm told. That these are only for cases that they will be put on the graph and into the system when a final order is issued, not when a recommended order is issued.
So this one case was...
Follow-up.
This one case that's about that's been waiting for election for some 22 months would probably increase that considerably then.
That's possible. As I understand it, you're probably referring to our case involving the Oregon Workers Union, and I understood that one of the parties circulated something, so I went back, and if you're interested, I can give you briefly what the timeline was, if that is what your question is.
That would be perfect. Thank you.
A petition was filed on July 105. It was amended on July 11th. The administrative law judge offered a date for first date for hearing about 3 months after the petition was filed. The parties, for whatever reason, weren't available immediately. It was delayed for some time so that the hearing didn't occur until mid-November. The hearing concluded, it was a three-day hearing. The hearing concluded on November 18. Typically, we have parties submit briefs within 14 days. The parties agreed to something more than a month, to about 5 weeks to submit the briefs. And so that was at the parties' request. And then the parties again requested an extension for the due date on briefs so that they weren't due until January 9th, 2006. That was the close of the hearing. The matter was then submitted to the administrative law judge. Upon the close of hearing, the administrative law judge issued a recommended order some 4.5 months later. The losing party filed objections. The parties were offered several dates for oral argument in front of the full agency, the full three-member board, the earliest being July 12th. The parties weren't available. They mutually agreed on a date of October 16, and the board order is currently pending.
Thank you.
Okay. We're at page 7 behind Appendix A, Performance Measure 2, and actually the next... three performance measures are direct measures of timeliness of the hearings division. The first one, the one on page 7, is it's divided into two parts. It's the number of days until and after filing of a complaint until the administrative law judge is first available, in other words, offers the party a date, and then the second measure is the date of the actual hearing. And probably the more important one is the date the administrative law judge is actually available. Often there are delays. The parties mutually request to settle to it's Christmas break. It's for whatever the reasons are, the parties are unavailable. So on these two charts, the first date the administrative law judge is available, our targeted, again, this is golf, and it looks more like bowling. We're above Our target is 60 days, and we're up to 113 days.
I want to try to nuance your response a little bit, because if timeliness is the issue here, I would expect a measure of that to be that the ALJ is always available. The parties might not be able to respond, but is it a function frequently that's driving the fact that you're behind the unavailability of an ALJ, or the inability of the parties to find a common date?
Right, and that's what these two charts measure. That was the intention of these two charts. Or breaking it down into the first date the ALJ, the administrative law judge, is available versus the date of the actual hearing. So the date the administrative law judge is first available for hearing is a function of how backed up the judge is in terms of hearings already scheduled, in terms of recommended orders that have to be written.
Again, I'm drawing on history of a couple of sessions ago, and God mercifully strikes some of this stuff after the session ends. But I recall testimony that may predate your time on the board, but that the agency frequently lacked the tools that you needed, and there were ALJs that were traipsing over to the Supreme Court to use the fundamental tools that a law firm, and that's basically part of what you are, ought to have, access to case law. Has that, and then, as if memory serves me, there were some ALJs that were trying to work from home, or there was some other difficulties. What I'm trying to ascertain is everybody present and accounted for every day, and are all the tools required to discharge your responsibilities available to you?
Senator Johnson, the issues that you're referring to, I believe, arose in the last session, although my memory is equally hazy in some regards. The research tools, we obtained money in this last biennium to get some online research tools that were made available to everyone so that board members and administrative law judges didn't, as you pointed out, have to traipse over to the library every time they wanted to do research. Transcripts were another issue where hearings would occur, and to go back and check themselves to recall precisely what testimony was, we didn't have transcripts. Had to literally sit and listen in real time to tapes, and we have also, at least for the time being, corrected that. We found money in the last biennium to transcribe most, but not all, of the hearings. Some of the smaller fee bills that are before the committee at this point are seemingly for, and I'll talk about those in the policy packages, seemingly for reasonably small amounts, like I believe one is $11,000 for the biennium and another is $13,000 for the biennium. It's the money essentially that we will need to earmark in order to be able to make transcripts available. But yes, the answer is yes, everyone is available and accounted for. And in addition, one of the things that we did to make sure that there were no wasted days because the backlog was getting bad, we prohibited our administrative law judges from traveling. Historically, we have always gone out to a community where the dispute arises because there's one of us and often 5, 10, 20 witnesses. And instead of having administrative law judges travel a day to and a day from, we decided that things were so dire with the personnel that we needed to recapture those 2 days so that the administrative law judges would be available to do hearings and to write their orders. The result, however, is that local public bodies and local unions often have to pay really quite large expenses to bring large groups of people. We hold our hearings only in Portland or in Salem at this time. And if there's a hearing, for example, in Klamath Falls or in Pendleton, they have to pay to bring the entire crew over almost always put them up overnight. If it's a multi-day hearing, it can be quite expensive. But we have squeezed everything that we can think of out of the time of the administrative law judges that we currently have.
And so just to follow up, the administrative law judges are all showing up. Nobody's working at home. The board is all showing up. Nobody's working at home.
No, there have been some allowances for people to work at home to do writing on days that they do writing. To telecommute.
Okay, and given the backlog situation, you're monitoring that very carefully. I understand the need to have some degree of quiet to write well, but I just would like you to reassure the panel that you're monitoring those away days very closely.
We have in recent time completely reexamined our telecommuting policy, have written new policies, have tightened it up. Had people sign contracts about when they will be available, when they will work very particularly, and I can assure you that everyone is complying with that, and I feel comfortable that everyone is putting in a full day and very often a full day and then some of work.
Thank you. Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, you mentioned the transcripts and the writing and that sort of thing, just to kind of help me understand a couple of things. When a transcript is ordered, are you using a transcriptionist to actually move the information from tape onto paper, or are you using voice recognition software, or what?
Chair Johnson, Representative Crummell, that is a question that I spent actually some time looking into. The short answer is that we have people that manually transfer the tapes, and actually now it's digital, it's discs, but that do the transcripts from the voice. We looked into several years ago, actually I did it, looked into the availability of voice recognition, which seemed like it would be a great opportunity, and it turned out that it's at the level of sophistication where there's more than one voice and there's new voices, it simply isn't available yet. I understand that the techie type people are working on it, and I'm told that if it were available, it would be currently so prohibitively expensive as to not be available at all for all practical purposes. But that seems to be one of the things that is on the technical horizon.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Kind of along those same lines then, when an ALJ is doing their work, do they generally tend to actually sit down and compose, you know, write or computer or whatever, or do they tend to dictate their material and then have a transcriptionist move it over?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, having been around the office, all of us do input. We don't have staff. If we were to dictate things, we wouldn't have any staff available to transcribe it. We're already somewhat short-staffed. And so the answer is that we all sit down with in front of a computer with a blank screen and fill it up with our words.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Kind of along those same lines, is that something that could be helpful and actually help the agency reduce their backlog? If you were to have staff assigned or the ability to contract with a transcription company, that sort of thing, to have, and I don't know, you know, some people do better when they actually see the words or they're writing it by pen or seeing it on the computer, and some people do just fine with dictations and then getting drafts back to look at and modify and send them back and that sort of thing. So I'm just curious as to, because it seems to me that having a, you know, I don't know how much an ALJ makes, but it seems to me that however much they make, it seems like it's kind of expensive to have them sitting in front of a computer when we can have them sitting in front of plaintiffs and defendants and doing their and then dictating their orders and that sort of thing. I'm just kind of curious about that.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, that is a question that I don't immediately have an answer to because it has never been anything that has been available to us. What I can tell you from my own perspective and from other people whose work styles I have seen is that it will depend on the individual. I think, like you said, some people would be very comfortable dictating, and it would be quite a bit faster, and others probably need to see the words in front of them. So I suspect that the answer to your question would be yes, it would speed things up for some people whose work style would fit in with them.
Okay. I'm just kind of wondering, Mr. Chair, if it wouldn't be something for us to sort of look at in terms of their budget and having them report back to JLAC or report back to e-board with regards to, you know, what kind of costs that might incur and whether that kind of an investment would be worthwhile that might aid the agency. And maybe they would look at it and say, this won't work. But I'm just wondering if that wouldn't be something for them to kind of pursue and see if you know, bumping their staff budget enough to get a transcriptionist or be able to contract with a transcriptionist wouldn't be a good idea. Thank you for that idea.
Senator Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would follow with Representative Crummell there in that it appears that in their budget there's about a 2% is to elections, about 24% each give or take to mediation and arbitration, and 50% is to administration. And it'd be very interesting for me to clarify how that's divided up, because 50% for administration seems rather high.
Chair Jensen and Senator Whitsitt, my understanding is that administration covers the entire three-person board and the staff that work for the board, as separate from the elections division, the hearings division, and the mediation and conciliation service. I assume that for maybe it's not the best term to call it administration, but what, as I understand it, what that money is the board itself. So we are at performance measure.
Can I, Mr. Chair, may I follow up on Senator Whitsitt's question? Paul, that's good for us to understand from the standpoint. So what you're saying is, and the board is full time, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understood that correctly. And so, so the administration also falls into the resolution of cases, or the resolution of cases, I guess I should say it the other way, the resolution of cases actually falls into the administration from a standpoint of how you're budgeting because of the fact that the board is a full-time board. So it's you're working every day, all day, and you might be doing something to do with board policy, or you might be making decisions on a case, and it's sort of commingled, correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, that yes, I think that's an accurate depiction.
Okay, thank you.
We are at performance measure 2, which is the availability of administrative law judges to their first availability and then the actual hearing dates. And without belaboring it, we are considerably higher in a measure where we prefer to be lower than the target. And again, I don't see that, frankly, changing in any significant way, if anything going up as a backlog continues, unless there is some additional staff to help reduce the backlog.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Paul, I apologize for continuing to interrupt you, but are there the time frames that are noted I really have two questions around this. One is, are the time frames in statute from the standpoint that you have a certain number of days as an agency to get things done? And if so, then is there an ability of the parties to toll the days? That's one question. The other question is, are these numbers on the page realistic? I mean, from a standpoint, you know, average days from date of filing a contested case to the first date ALJ is available for a hearing, you have 60 days as a target, but 113 days ends up being kind of the actual. And I'm just wondering, is 60 days, number one, is 60 days a realistic number?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, we have not tracked. This is one of those new performance measures. We split it up. The performance measure previously had simply been this second part, which was the time to the actual first date of hearing, and we thought that didn't accurately capture the availability of the administrative law judges, because some of the delay was not because of the administrative law judges. So we wanted to have these two separate measures that separated them out. Whether it is realistic for an administrative law judge to be available within 60 days, it could be 75 days, it could be 45 days, but it's a number that I think is certainly in the ballpark of realistic, and I think we'll talk a little bit more in a minute about what happens when hearings are slowed down, when an administrative law judge can't get to a case in a timely fashion, and what kind of impact that has on the process and on people in the real world. As to your question about timelines, the only timeline that immediately comes to mind in statute is in the state personnel relations law, where we act as the civil service board. We have to schedule a hearing within 30 days, and the answer is yes. The parties often can and often do mutually request an extension of time on that to prepare. But because of the statute, we will always make available a date within 30 days of the filing of the complaint, because the statute requires it. But there are, to my recollection, there are no other such timelines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Performance measure 3 is also of the administrative law judges, and it is a percentage of the cases assigned to an administrative law judge that settle. And one of the things that we have found in tracking this is that when the administrative law judges have more time to work a case, if you will, the settlement rate goes up. And when the administrative law judges can do nothing more than simply, you know, run like their hair's on fire just to get through the process and don't have time to work a case, the numbers go down. So we've got on the chart on page 9 in 01, 02, 03, we had 3 administrative law judges and a settlement rate of 55%. In 04, 05, we dropped to 2 administrative law judges plus about a half-time contract judge. Had some vacancy savings and some money that we could use to take some of the workload off. It went down to 48%. In 06, we didn't have the additional money, so we were just with 2 administrative law judges, and it went down to 42%. And I'm told that for the first 6 months of this fiscal year, the 06-07 fiscal year, we're down to 32%. So it's, I think, another measure of what happens when the administrative law judges are backlogged. So it's not only delays in cases, but cases that might otherwise settle aren't all settling. Performance measure.
No, I'm not troubled. Well, I am troubled a little bit.
Okay.
I was just listening to you talk and thinking about the previous exchanges here, and wondering if you're unable to find any budget relief in this session and you're not able to hire additional people, when do you get to a point where you are not able to discharge your statutory responsibilities and when do parties decide maybe they're going to challenge you legally?
Representative Jensen, Senator Johnson. They're two different questions. We have heard, and this, you know, it's in an informal way, but people are starting to say that they're not coming to the agency anymore because things are so slow and they're not getting satisfaction, which means that some disputes are going unresolved. And I don't know, I can't speak to how widespread that is. As to at what point, I think that's a very insightful and accurate question, because we will at some time reach a point where we effectively are not carrying out our statutory functions and could potentially face a lawsuit for failing to do that. I don't know at what point that arises, but yes, we are, and I, in my view, we are approaching that point.
Thank you.
Senator, if I could, as I read this, material over the weekend, I wondered if they weren't past that point.
Well, we are struggling mightily, Chair Jensen, and we're here to talk about hopefully some relief for it. I mean, we're just laying out the data and the information that we have, and we as an agency are reaching much the same conclusion that you have reached. The performance measure number 4, again, is a measure of the timeliness of administrative law judge function. So after the administrative law judge conducts a hearing and gets the briefs from the party, the next step is that the administrative law judge writes a recommended order. So this is a measure of how long it takes from the close of the record until the administrative law judge issues a recommended order. And again, as I talked about golf or bowling, this is a golf. We want to be below the number, and we have some historical data. In 01, 02, 03, when we had 3 administrative law judges, it varied some, but it was in the 60s and 70s in terms of the number of days. In 04, 05, when we were down to 2 plus a contract judge, it went up to 87 days. And now in 06, when we're down to just 2 administrative law judges, it has, I guess not surprisingly, continued to rise so that it's now 117 days. A third administrative law judge, based on the historical data, should mean that we can get somewhere in the neighborhood of cutting that time almost in half, based on the historical data, from 117 days in 06 to the 60s and 60 days up to 77 days in that 3-year period where we had 3 administrative law judges.
Thank you, and I note that our time is slipping away pretty quickly here, and we've only got about 10 minutes before we go to public testimony. So
I would ask the chair and the committee members what in that 10 minutes would be the most useful thing, the most useful information I could provide. I could continue with performance measures, or I could talk about the policy packages are the two main things.
I'd like to hear about the policy packages, but Senator Johnson.
Two things, Mr. Chair. I'd like to hear about the policy packages, but also perhaps hearing the public testimony and the public reaction to what's happening at the agency might further instruct our conversation here.
Further down, yeah.
Okay, we have 3 policy packages. The one that I think is most pertinent is in the governor's recommended budget to add a third administrative law judge, and I'm not going to go through the performance measures again.
Where are we going for these in your book?
Page 11 is the first one, the administrative law judge, where that begins. We call it the critical workload package.
Page 11 under the...
Page 11 in the main body of the text, not in the appendix, but in the main body of the text. The performance measures speak for themselves. I believe that they indicate a pretty strong need for an additional administrative law judge. And I do want to spend a minute or two of time to say, if somebody was inclined to say, so what, some of the decisions are slow, so what? So I would like to talk about that briefly from an employer's point of view and from labor's point of view. From the employer's point of view, we have a lot of cases that involve people who get dismissed, laid off, and they think that those dismissals or the layoffs are improper, and they come to us and ask us to overturn them. A recent example is a mass layoff in a school district. It was challenged before us, and we determined that the layoff was improper. And one of the remedies we gave is say, pay those people, give them their back pay. You should not have laid them off. So from a public employer's perspective, I don't remember how many people, let's say it was 50 people who were laid off. Back pay for 50 people over a six-month period versus back pay for 50 people over an 18-month period. That is a considerable difference, and it's money out of the taxpayer's pocket. So that is one fairly striking way in which employers are impacted by slow decisions. Employees, of course, if they have lost their job and are entitled to back pay, they may not be able to hold on. You know, there are, by statute, 6 months to collect unemployment benefits. Somebody may have some savings that may well get eaten up pretty quickly. Even if at the end of the process they get money back, they may have to uproot their family and move to another community to get work. They may lose their houses and cars. The point is that it's not just a theoretical thing. There are real human costs in slow decisions out of this agency.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
And if the agency isn't optimally performing, and the question that was posed earlier, what if you weren't here? What happens to these disputes at this point? They go directly into the courts, or?
Presumably, if there is a statute and there's no agency to administer them, they would go directly into the courts. And I suspect it would get even slower at that point.
That was
glacially slow,
that
as
was
opposed
the follow-up to question that I had. We go from slow to slower.
Slow to slower.
Slow to stop. Okay.
But because of time, I'll move on to our another policy package, which is arbitrator panel. On page 13, it's Senate Bill 58. By statute, the agency is required to maintain a list of qualified labor arbitrators to decide. Private arbitrators, not employees of the agency, but private arbitrators that the parties can use to resolve interest arbitration disputes, grievance arbitration disputes, and the like. And we administer that. There is a lot of work involved administering that, finding the people and sending out lists, culling the lists, handling complaints, removing people from the list, and the like. And we have to date absorbed that cost, and this is a bill that would include a $50 fee for processing requests to be on our arbitration panel and a $100 annual maintenance fee. We anticipate it's a small amount of money that it would raise. I believe there are 67 current people on the labor arbitration panel. It's anticipated to raise about $11,000, a little over $11,000 for the biennium, so a little over $5,000 per year. And the fee, the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service is the other government agency. It's a federal agency that does something similar to that. They have lists, and my understanding is that they charge $100 a year maintenance fee, so we would be equalizing with that, and we would use the money well. And then the last package, which is on page 14, It's House Bill 2070, and it involves fees. And actually, I think this has turned into a bit of a dispute, and so I'll take just a second to just review how it all came about. Well, first of all, the bill itself ended up having two parts. We sent it to Legislative Council to draft to deal with our fees, and when Legislative Council looked at it, they determined that our agency isn't in compliance with general standards for the small agencies in that we don't have a trust account that we put our money in that earns interest for us. So part of that bill is to create a trust account, an interest-bearing account for all of the agency's funds. That is anticipated, I believe, to raise about $20,000 for the biennium just for the interest on our money. And that's part of it. The second part is really what the...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Paul, where does that money currently go? If the interest, it must be making interest someplace. Where does it currently go?
My understanding is that it goes into the general fund.
Thank you.
Joe, is that correct?
I was just going to clarify that it is a sub-account for the Department of Administrative Services currently where the Employment Relations Board fees and assessments goes, and then it's split off by DAS and sent to the agency as the funding mechanism. And, yes, the interest does go to the general fund.
Thank you.
We started out to make a small change in the fee structure, and it arose out of a task force that issued a report in, I believe, early 2005. It was a governor's task force. There was a governor's representative on it. I was on it for the agency. Representative Butler was on it, and there were, I believe, three or four people each from labor and management. And what came out of that were two principles. One is that the private sector doesn't pay any filing fee, whereas the public sector does. And so principle one was impose a filing fee on the private sector that is equal to the filing fee in the public sector. The second was that if there are going to be any fees at all, they should be borne equally by labor and management. We looked at our fee structure. Complaints, the fee for a complaint is higher than the fee for an answer. Complaints are filed about 80%, maybe even 90% by labor. Answers are filed 80 or 90% by management, so there was not an equalization. So this simply started off to be a bill to equalize labor and management's input into the fee by making the answer fee the same, $250, as the filing fee. I understand that while it was in committee, some people had recommended some changes to increase fees across the board. I don't know what form the bill that will come to this committee will be in, but my understanding is that the governor's recommended budget is built around the equalization part of the fee, but not the additional fees that some have suggested. And I think that is all of our policy packages.
Representative Beyer.
Just a quick question. In the changes that have occurred in this bill, 2070, are the fees equal, which was the main purpose of this?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beyer, my understanding is that the fees would not be equal. The numbers that I had heard proposed were increasing the filing fee from $250 to $400 and increasing the answer fee to $300 and then imposing an additional fee on cases that go to the full board.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to, at this point, end the presentation by the board and open the public testimony. We'll have a list here momentarily. One of the questions, I guess, before you run away from there, sorry for not being able to be here to begin with, but I did note in reading through this material that you seem in relationship to Herb, as you talk about the clientele, to talk about state employees, public employees as state employees, and if memory serves me correctly, there are a whole bunch of public employees out there that are not state employees, which in the language that has been used here have been, in a number of instances, have excluded from the report. As being one of those other, you know, I take some at least minimal offense to being left out in the
Chair Jensen, I can assure you no offense was intended.
I'm sure of that.
We represent not only state employees, but police and fire and teachers and community college and other higher education and all local government, yes.
Local government, I guess, was what seemed to be omitted in a number of places.
Yes.
Okay. For the record, that was not an intended error, but should have been there then. Okay. Thank you. We've got the Oregon Workers Union, Craig Chadwick and John Schmidtall. Is that correct? Would both of you come up? And then following that, I'm going to ask for Mary Bodkin and Richard Schwartz. Mary Bodkin with AFSCME and Richard with the American Federation of Teachers. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Chair Jensen, the representatives. My name is John Schmidtall. I am with the Oregon Workers Union. I'm the president. I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I do highway work. I do highway work. Sorry about the way I'm dressed. I came from work. I got to get back to work. And somewhat like the Employee Relations Board, we're short-staffed also. So we try to get out there and keep the interstate running up and down, keep the stuff off the highway so people don't run into it, do the maintenance out on the highway, and that is a tremendous job for us. This is Craig Chadwick. He's also with Oregon Workers Union. He also works for ODOT. He's our communications and
statewide
communications coordinator. We were just going to have speak a little bit on how our
each group, the two of you would be allocated about 6 minutes between.
We'll try to go
both of you, 3 minutes each or 6 minutes for one, whichever way you choose to do it.
Ready. Craig's going to just give you a quick overview of what we've gone through with trying to get an election to get out of the union SEIU.
Chair Jensen, members. Two things I had questions on, and I'd kind of like to get on the record first. I heard...
For the record, before you begin, your name.
For the record, my name is Craig Chadwick, statewide communication coordinator for the Oregon Workers Union. I work for ODOT. I live in Bombsville.
Thank you.
So let's just go with that then. I heard the chairperson for the ERB say that the final hearing before the board was in October of 2006. I believe it was actually August. I think that was a misspeaking. And I was concerned when I heard that one of the board members has since resigned. That sounds like there was just one of the two people that heard our case is still there, if I'm correct. That kind of scares us because the chair, I believe, recused himself on that case. Okay. My name is Craig. I've said that. The Oregon Workers Union filed a recertification petition for ODOT Local 730 workers with the Employment Relations Board on July 1 of 2005. This was 2 months after a unanimous vote at a statewide meeting of ODOT Local 730, which is our local. Our petition was filed under the ORS 243-682 and of the PECPA and in accordance with the OAR 115-25. For the record, SEIU revoked the right to membership of 6 of us for 5 years and 5 of us for 2 years in retaliation for our actions in July of 2005. It's never easy to get one of these petitions approved by the ERB because over the years the board has made case law favoring large bargaining units such as SEIU. That's not in the ORS, which says they should consider factors such as community of interest, wages, hours, and working conditions of employees, the history of collective bargaining, and the desire of the employees. So it works out to the desire of the employees is treated as a relatively minor consideration. We can't even get a vote for the employees without board approval. At any rate, we have carried out the wishes of our members with our petition for that vote and got a hearing in front of an ERB administrative law judge in November of 2005. The union had two lawyers. We just had ourselves. We managed to get through a hearing with the ALJ, and since the judge recommended against our petition, we appealed that to the full board. That appeal with the ERB was last August, over a year after filing our petition, and we've been waiting 7 months since then for a decision. We still have no decision, and it's been 22 months since our members voted to start this process. There is nothing in the law giving a timeline either. Now, it's been our experience that the PECBA makes it very hard for state workers to really have a voice in their representation, and we'd sure like to see that changed, but the long, drawn-out process of even getting a vote if we win our appeal means SEIU 503 has had 2 years to act and prepare for such a vote, while we've been stuck without budget as workers grow cynical about the whole process and due regard by the state for their rights to choose their representation. Our concern is that the long delay practically makes our petition moot, even if the board actually eventually decides we deserve an election. We saw what's called a blitz of paid SEIU staff going statewide trying to prevent our petition from being signed months ago. We have no illusions about the blitz that is coming from the union for a no vote if we get a vote. Delay piles impossible on top of unlikely and makes the whole process moot. In effect, the fraud on 577 ODOT workers who signed the petition. Today, we voice our opinion that the ERB needs to be much more efficient and speedy in handing down reasons and decisions. We can't speak to the ERB's staffing level, but we are in need and in favor of the legislature exercising oversight to make the process fairer for workers. For us, justice delayed is indeed justice denied. If the ERB wants to save time on cases like ours, why not just let our card count qualify us for an election? That would seem only fair when you consider that the AFL-CIO is supporting a card count bill that will allow them to take in new members on a card count without even bothering with an election. If that goes forward, and the same process for members changing their representation remains, we'll just be making a bigger trap for state employees, where it's easy for the union to get us in, but near impossible for us to get out. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Is there a quick question? Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Just one question, Mr. Chadwick. Have you folks studied the time at all, the relative time required to hold an election to create representation versus the time to hold an election to change or to discontinue representation?
I haven't personally, sir. Have you?
No.
Thank you. We'll ask staff that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate your being here in the working clothes. It's nice to see real people, not people who just spend all their time in the state capitol. So it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Mary and Richard, you wanted to come up with Jim Green?
I think the three of us can come up.
What about what him? Yes,
Mr. Chair, just before we're the next people come up, to save money, I don't think we're at the point where this committee is making decisions about particular cases. So it would help me if we focus on the impact of what's happening at the ERB and not on specific cases we're not making a decision that needs to be germane to what we're talking about. So I think that would be useful.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And just for the record, we don't represent ODOT. So we are unable to help these gentlemen. Our message to you as a subcommittee is pretty easy. We want this agency funded. When Chair Gamson talked about struggling with a shrinking budget and talked about increased timelines, he sort of alluded to the problems that workers face when timelines are artificially drawn out just because there's not enough staff to get the work done. And he also talked about what that means to the workers. But I think there's a bigger issue, and the bigger issue is that we have a relatively good state for labor relations. You don't see a lot of strikes. You don't see a lot of labor unrest, and part of that's because we have a good system that now is struggling to maintain itself. And when the system starts to break down, what you see is you see more cases moving to arbitration, you see more cases being unresolved, you see the workforce become more litigious just because they can't get a good decision quickly from ERB. They think that they ought to go to the courts. And that is not a good solution for us, for any of us, for our employers or for the employees and labor unions that represent them. To us, a good labor relations system is one that nobody knows exists, because you never really hear about it, you never see the actions, you never see strikes, you don't see a lot of labor unrest in the workplace. It means that people are focused on what they're supposed to be focused on, which is the job that they do, and they let folks like me and other employer reps that you'll see here today worry about sort of the day-to-day operations, about how labor relations functions. You know, we want quick action all the way down the line, and what we're seeing now is less quick action, longer delays in hearings, longer delays in decisions, and whatever mechanism it takes,
Mary,
we want it funded.
I was wondering if that's where you were concluding.
Whatever mechanism it takes, we want it funded.
You would like to have Representative Galizio spend three teachers for a administrative law judge?
Hey, I don't want to take money from Galizio's, you know, higher ed community college programs. Okay. And you know, we just think it's important that we get the money and we put it together in any innovative ways this subcommittee can find. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association today. This session, Mary and I have come together as the representatives from labor and management on many ERB issues. And one of the things that we're saying very loudly and very clearly together is fund this agency. The delay that you heard about from the gentleman from the Oregon Workers Union and the delay that you read in your reports from the Employment Relations Board and what Chair Gamson talked to you about today, I think is all linked back to the fact that this agency hasn't been funded adequately. And during the 2003 session, this subcommittee placed a budget note on the ERB budget that created an ERB funding task force, which I was a member of. And we got together, Mr. Gamson and Tom Chamberlain, who was then with the governor's office, called that group together. And we looked at a variety of ways to fund this agency. If you take a look at that report, what it essentially says from both management and labor is, you've created a system under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act and with the state employees under ORS 240 that you've set the rules by which management and labor have to play with. One of the rules that you set was disputes go to the Employment Relations Board. It's a state function. It's a state agency. It should be state funded. We took a look at a variety of scenarios trying to fund this agency, and one of the other principles we came up with was, if you can't fund it fully at a state agency, then fund it equally across employees and employers. Now, that's a tough thing for both employees and employers to swallow, especially in the era, remember, back in 2003, where in the K-12 community, we weren't looking at the funding increase that we're looking out of this biennium. And I know that's in Representative Galizio's committee, and we don't want to take funding away from K-12 to fund this, but we do believe that this agency performs a vital function. When you have labor unrest and you have cases that go for long periods of time, it creates uncertainty and unease out in our employment places with our employees and with employers. We believe that a quick quasi-judicial any sort of findings in this area that make it faster for these things to go away is better, and that's what ERB was set up to do. And I know Representative Edwards, Representative Beyer, you received a letter from Joe Richards, I believe, who's the attorney for the Eugene School District on several issues, encouraging you to fund the ALJ position. Very short letter, I believe, he sent through you electronically. As it relates to the policy option packages, let me talk to those real quickly. They desperately need another administrative law judge. And we believe that ought to be funded out of the general fund. And everyone, whether you're in management, whether you're in labor, believes that position needs to be funded. You heard about the delays that are taking place. They're not meeting their agency goals. And in order to do that, they need another ALJ. As it relates to Senate Bill 58, I have not been involved in that. Whether arbiters ought to pay that $50 and the $100, you ought to ask the people that are on that list. But I believe that $11,000 out of the biennium, and I think they vetted that out to folks from the Employment Relations Board, will provide them the necessary funds so that they're not eating that out of their budget. The final one, and I know this one has caused great concern in the building, is House Bill 2070. Mary and I served on a work group that looked at those fees. And unfortunately, not everybody could coalesce around the numbers that you heard Mr. Gamson talk about. I met with Representative Schaffler, who's the chair of the House General Government Committee, or the House Business and Labor Committee. That bill will be moving to your subcommittee as it was written with the $250 for both sides. His decision was to send it down to you and have you take a look at those fees and see whether they're reasonable or not. One of the things I think you heard from Chair Gamson today is they do need to set up that trust account so that interest goes to the Employment Relations Board where that money's due to take place. Our concern is that this agency needs to be funded. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of American Federation of Teachers Oregon. I have been involved in processing cases before this Employment Relations Board and Employment Relations Board and boards in several other states and before the National Labor Relations Board and the Federal Labor Relations Authority. I join in my colleagues here in urging the subcommittee's support for funding the administrative law judge position. There are other anecdotal incidents that I could recite for you just to show the degradation or the how far the board's resources have sunk in recent years. There's been occasions when I've called or that my staff has called the Employment Relations Board and the chairman has answered the phone, which is not a good use of the chairman's time. There are occasions in hearings in contested cases or in representation case hearings where the hearings officer is responsible for all the mechanical operation of the tape recorder and the machines, and so in the course of testimony, instead of having an assistant, as once was the case, to manage the equipment and see that a record is kept, that they have to take time out to reverse tapes and load new tapes while the hearing is trying to progress. There are many occasions like that that have caused delays and have underutilized the resources, such as those of the ALJ or members of the board, who could be spending their valuable time on the more important elements of the case, but without sufficient staff, they've had to do their own support work in many cases. In the case of transcripts, there's been occasions where we were able to order copies of the tape and then had to find our own transcriptionist to transcribe the recording to written documents or reproduced documents so that we could get information we needed from the hearing. The main reason I'd like to speak to you in the few minutes I have left is about the fees themselves. There's not many opportunities to discuss the fees, in particular the filing fees for the contested cases. A couple things I'd like to focus or remind the subcommittee, the members of the subcommittee about is that the statute and the labor relations system is almost routinely viewed as unions and employers. If you look at the statutory scheme, the construction of the statute, it's not it's neither about employers or unions, but it's about individual rights. And it is the rights of individuals to form, join, or participate in labor organizations. That's the core of the statute. If fees are levied for contested cases, and I know we've lived with one fee, the $250 filing fee and the $100 answer for a few years now, but what you're functionally talking about is that an individual who wants to pursue their rights, who may not yet be represented, but maybe in the early stages of exploring unionization, and chooses to talk with colleagues about unionization, and for some reason is harmed in their employment or believes they are harmed in their wages, hours, or terms and conditions of employment, they have a right to follow through by filing a complaint with the Employment Relations Board. Whether it's $250 or higher numbers that have been tossed around or have been discussed in the building, those go to that individual. If the union or an individual feels that their union has not represented them fairly, they are responsible for filing a duty of fair representation complaint against the union and the employer. The individual is responsible for that fee. It's not always the concept that seems to be ingrained, is that it's about the union and its treasury and the employer and its tax dollars.
I think we're a little over time already, so could you wrap up, please?
I'll do that. But think of it in this sense, that where fees are involved, that the collective bargaining laws, whether in the private sector or the public sector, are essentially the first anti-discrimination laws. You cannot be harmed or should not be harmed for pursuing your statutory right. Consider, if you will, that if somebody had a gender discrimination complaint or a religious discrimination complaint or other and went to pursue a remedy through the Bureau of Labor and Industries or the EEOC, they're not required to file or make a filing fee in order to pursue that right. And having any kind of filing fees for contested cases is the one, it means that labor is, or the individuals or their unions are responsible for that. For employers, it's cost shifting. The employer, whether it's $100 or $250, it's still out of the employer's tax dollars. For individuals, it's out of their pocket or their collective pockets. And the last thing I want to say is that I provided a chart with my written testimony that compares this to about 15 other states, and Oregon is not just high, but way out of off the charts.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And could I have Thomas Gunn and Dale Shepherd, Mr. Gunn with the Portland Public Schools and Dale with the AFL-CIO. In case there's controversy, Mr. Gunn is first on the list.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Gunn. I currently am employed as the Director of Labor Relations for Portland Public Schools. During the 80s, I was a union advocate for AFSCME, trying cases at the Employment Relations Board. During the 90s, I was actually a member of a quasi-judicial board, the Workers' Compensation Board, so I have some idea of the difficulties that Paul has in administering justice through timelines. During most of 2000, I have been an employer advocate, also trying cases at the Employment Relations Board. And I am here today supporting any policy changes to build this agency back to what it was, which was a viable way for parties to resolve disputes in a timely and efficient manner. My experience is in Marion County. I filed a unit clarification case, which is not even an adversarial type of hearing. It's basically a fact-finding hearing to determine whether or not somebody should be in a particular union or not in another union. And that case took about a year and a half, and it would have taken longer except that they had some additional funds and they were able to get the decision written by their contract ALJ a little bit sooner. Part of the delay that they talked about is the parties themselves. I mean, right now, if I have a dispute or one of the unions files a dispute, I'm probably not going to be available for a hearing for the next 2 months because I have bargaining with other unions and other disputes to resolve. But a lot of the delay now is just called because they don't have the capacity or the resources to perform the job. So for that reason, as a member of management, for very pragmatic reasons that relate to the potential liability that you face whenever you go into a case, for example, in the UC case, I could have wound up paying union dues for a number of people for almost a year and a half, and that would have been a pretty substantial hit upon the taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shepard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Duke Shepard with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I apologize for my terrible handwriting.
My apologies to you, sir.
No, not at all. And I'll just be very brief. We're here to support the ERB budget and the ALJ position. I've been on both sides of the table, labor and management, and timely and efficient access to the system is designed for both parties, for all people who have rights under the public employee collective bargaining law. And I'll just briefly echo Mr. Schwartz's comments in that the rights under these laws are accrued to individuals, and a more heavy reliance on fees is something we would prefer not to see in that. And I think you heard the perfect illustration with the first gentleman who testified. Think less about the sort of broad categories of labor and management. You have individuals who don't want to be in a union anymore, and they don't have a group to help them access the system. So to the extent that you can rely less on fees, though we understand you've got a tough budget work to do here, and that may be part of the ultimate solution, but the less you can rely on fees, the better that will ultimately be for people to access the system. But the most important thing is to fund the ERB and the ALJ position, no matter what you do at the end. Thank you.
Thank you for your words. I appreciate that. And the final two we have is Mr. Bennett and Ms. Smith. Mr. Bennett is in there. Ms. Bennett, I'm sorry. I wasn't going to take a chance on the pronunciation of the first name since I blew a much more complicated one with Duke.
Good morning, Chair Jensen. My name is Donna Bennett. And I am here this morning. Currently, I am a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice. I'm here this morning, however, in a capacity that I think is fairly unique, and that is I just, as the month of February ended, I ended my tenure as chair of the ERB board. So I am in the position of having been and am again a constituent of ERB and also having worked there and learning some of the secrets of the temple. I support this budget. I think it is vital to this agency that you too support this budget. Chair Jensen, you said earlier, at what point does this agency cease to meet its statutory obligation? I think we are on the edge. When I was chair, I had the dubious responsibility of telling constituents that we could not afford to send ALJs out to their areas to hear contested hearings. Why? We didn't have the money to reimburse them for mileage, to give them hotels at night. Now, the upside of that was we kept the ALJs in town so that they could write more. But as Chair Gamson said earlier, the downside also is we tell constituents you have to bring all of your witnesses, all of your counsels into town. For small school districts, that meant shutting down a district for a day to bring everybody into town. We talk about use of money. That's a very poor use of our education dollars. I support the policy packages that have been set before you. Whatever you can do to support this agency to help it do what it is statutorily obligated to do is desperately needed. And part of that right now, which is very crucial, is the authority to hire a third administrative law judge. That will clean up the contested docket fairly easily, and it will move things through the agency so that labor and management disputes can be resolved as they should be. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Monica Smith. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I've been a constituent of the ERB for the last 25 years. I represent public sector labor unions. I'm here today not on behalf of any of my clients, but really on my own behalf, because I, in the last 25 years, have seen the decline of the ERB, and I'm here to support the messages you've already heard about the importance of the ERB and the importance of adequate funding. And at the very least, that does mean we need an additional administrative law judge. Just to give a human face to this concern, let me talk very briefly about a case I had in the last couple of years. I represented the union who represented custodians in a school district. The school district contracted out the custodian's work. We challenged that contracting out as illegal. It took 16 months to get to a final decision. We won. But the unfortunate thing is, during that time, those custodians who had family wage jobs were thrown out of work. Many of them could not find adequate substitute work. Some of them had to travel 100 miles. The examples that Paul gave earlier all came true. Some lost houses. Some had to withdraw their PERS accounts. Some underwent divorces because of the tremendous strain that this put on their families. And when they were ultimately offered their jobs back and back pay after 16 months, that remedy could not in any way address the losses that they had suffered. You can imagine what it would be like to try to put your life back together after being unemployed or underemployed for a 16-month period. And ERB can only give back pay, nothing to address other damages or pain or suffering that you might have incurred. So that's just one example of what happens when justice is delayed. And now 16 months is a rather efficient decision. The times have stretched out to 18 months or 2 years, and the problems are becoming even worse. I also just wanted to give one example of the problem of lack of travel funds. One of my partners had an unfair labor practice case recently, which in which the employer was Josephine County. So both the union and the county had to send their witnesses to Salem. These witnesses included a county commissioner, the human resources director for the county, mental health counselors, all sorts of people who could have been doing better things or greater services probably if they stayed home, but instead they had to spend their time traveling to Salem instead of one judge being able to go to the location where the eight witnesses were. So another judge is very important. Travel time is very important. And I just wanted to say also that I think the current budget proposal before you is really a very modest proposal. I wish that the agency could add two more administrative law judges, so instead of just holding hearings, they could actually come pull the parties together ahead of time and try to resolve cases without litigation, that they could push us to schedule hearings sooner instead of waiting for us to come to them with a hearing date. I also wish that the agency had far more clerical help, because as Representative Crummell was indicating earlier, the judges are spending time doing work that I think is more appropriately assigned to another person. Perhaps not word processing. I'm a great word processor myself, and I think that's effective, but I think they do a lot of their own filing and just basic paper maintenance. They do a lot of their own scheduling, and if there were more clerical support, they could spend that time more doing judicial work. I don't really have a position on the fees. I don't pay them. My clients do, but I just hope you can find a way to give adequate support to this very important agency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate both of your testimony. I have particularly Donna, who I just originally. You know, there are a couple of things. I mean, some of the problems and some of the inefficiencies may be because of not having enough administrative law judges or having enough, perhaps, other staff. That's one possibility. The other possibility is maybe there's just inefficiencies that are built in somehow or another in the agency that are creating, you know, so that if you had two more law judges and three more clerical staff, you'd still be running behind. And I see somebody shaking their head. No, but, you know, this I appreciate that if you don't have enough, you're not able to do the job. I also appreciate that numbers are not always the criteria that, you know, one needs to have. And I'm not sure. I see a lot of turnover in the agency as I was reading through and going through the report, and it strikes me that massive turnover that's taken place is a major cause of some of the delays that are going to be taking place, whether it's at your administrative law judge, whether it's at the board, or whether it's in the clerical staff. I mean, you simply have a lot of loss of time when new people come in and have to replow the same ground that's been plowed before or be retrained into positions. I'm getting at a question there as in your past experience of how can we be assured that it's not an internal problem rather than a number of people problem?
Chair Jensen, I think that's a legitimate question. But let me answer it by saying that the turnover has been primarily within the ERB board itself. The secretarial staff that we have there presently, for the most part, there are two women who have been there for over 20 years. We've lost people in the secretarial support staff. So that has been a turnover in the sense that they are now gone. Two people, their positions were cut, and they're gone. So we have two people now doing the work of four people. With regard to the state mediators, we have three. One of them recently left to take, a higher-paying job elsewhere. He had been with the agency for approximately 2 years. The other two mediators have been there for many, many years. So the turnover, I would counter, is with terms coming up on the board and positions just being eliminated.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your testimonies. And we will continue this discussion on Thursday. That's correct. We're adjourned. Thank you, Ms.